Welcome to Hill Country Institute Live, the program that brings you together with Christian leaders, authors, and pastors to discuss major issues of our time. We seek to encourage and equip followers of Jesus Christ to show His heart and mind in all that we do. I'm Larry Lenin-Schmidt, your host, and I thank you for joining us today. We have a special program with a Christian thought leader, author, and professor who has written on the issues of faith and work and the concern of how we cope with technological advances, particularly artificial intelligence. Stay with us. You want to hear more about virtue in business, how humans have benefited from technological advances in history, and particularly how we will be impacted and benefit from artificial intelligence. We invite you to visit our website, hillcountryinstitute.org, to hear podcasts of our past radio programs on topics including faith and work, science and art, fighting human trafficking, the spiritual formation of C.S. Lewis, and much more. We've had many interesting guests, including Oz Guinness, Dan Davis, and Andy Crouch, and others. The website also offers audio and video from our past conferences and seminars on faith and science and other topics. And our radio programs are also available on podcast as Hill Country Institute Live. The program is supported by donations, and you can donate to support this program at hillcountryinstitute.org. For donations over $100, you have your choice of The Human Advantage, The Future of American Work in an Age of Smart Machines by our guest Jay Richards, or another book on specific aspects of faith and culture. Contact us at 512-680-7993 for additional information. Visit hillcountryinstitute.org to donate, and please contact us if you would like to sponsor this program. Our guest today, Jay Richards, is the author of The Human Advantage, The Future of American Work in an Age of Smart Machines. He earned his Ph.D. in philosophy and theology from Princeton, is a research professor at the Bush School of Business at the Catholic University of America, and is an executive editor of The Stream, which features articles on faith, work, and many other cultural topics. Now, let's welcome our special guest, Jay Richards. Jay, thank you for being with us today. Welcome to Hill Country Institute Live.
Thanks, Larry. It's good to be with you.
Thank you. I'd like for our audience to get to know you a little bit personally. Tell us about your family. You mentioned them in your book.
Yeah, I do, actually. And so I'm married and live now, actually, in Washington, D.C. I have two daughters. One is 19 and one is 15. My 19-year-old, we're actually a homeschooling family. So our 15-year-old, though she's in high school, is homeschooled. And which really, in this part of the country, we call it drive school, because you're involved in co-ops and all sorts of different things.
Oh, sure.
You're not literally in the house all day. And then my 19-year-old, Jillian, is actually a sophomore at Catholic University, where I'm on the faculty. And we actually live in a townhouse just about 200 yards from the campus here in Washington, D.C., which is really nice. But I was for many years full-time at the Discovery Institute in Seattle. And so my daughters still sort of feel and think of themselves as Seattleites. But we've lived in the Washington, D.C. area now for over 5.5 years.
Well, that's two of the most interesting places to live in the country, I would think.
Yeah, one is beautiful, one is interesting. But, you know, when we first moved to Washington, D.C., lived in suburban Virginia at the time, from Seattle, it did take some getting used to. That's the problem with living in Seattle, is it's so beautiful that almost any place that you move is, you know, kind of a downgrade in terms of natural beauty. But Washington, D.C. is great because there's just so much happening. And so, you know, I felt like in some ways we were sort of bound to end up here at some point, and that's what happened.
Well, and being on the edge of the campus, you're just part of that whole environment, the academic environment, the people who come to speak. It's got to be very rich for your family.
It really is. I mean, and that's the funny thing that you don't necessarily think about, but because, you know, for good or for ill, Washington, D.C. is the center of political power on planet Earth, essentially. And so there are people coming through here constantly. So that when I first moved here, honestly, Larry, I mean, Seattle's a great place, but it's not like there are 20 really important events, mm-hmm. all of which you feel like you need to be attending, happening simultaneously. That's how Washington, D.C. is. There's always several things. When I got here for a few months, I sort of was at anxiety because I felt like, oh, I'm missing this very important meeting, or I'm missing this briefing or this lecture. And you eventually just get used to it and have to decide, okay, what great things am I going to miss today so that I can prioritize something else?
Sure. Well, we have probably a lesser standard of that here in Austin with the state capitol and being a tech center. Mm-hmm. And there's literally always something you know, literally almost every day, something you could go see. And it's a little bit disruptive with traffic and everything. But
yeah.
You know, being in Washington and thinking about business and economics, you're a professor at the Bush School of Business there at the university, mm-hmm. and that you've got this great policy statement. In Washington, D.C., the Center of Business Policy, we are unleashing virtue-based free enterprise to lift the human person and transform the culture. I mean, everybody I know yeah. that's working on faith in business just can resonate with that statement. It's wonderful.
It really is, and it's really exciting to be at a business school that has anchored that, this virtue-based approach to free enterprise, into our mission statement. I mean, there's always been a Department of Business at CUA, but the Bush Business School itself is only about 6 years old, and to just be able to sort of start from the ground up with that kind of thinking, it is exciting, and it's exciting to be able to do it in a Christian context and to be able to do it in Washington, D.C., because we're convinced that, you know, for good or for ill, the primary way in which value and wealth is created and poverty is alleviated in the world that God actually created is by way of business. And we're so often used to either thinking of it as just a kind of cutthroat dog-eat-dog enterprise or as just a necessary evil. But we, in fact, think that, yes, the world has fallen, but there is a redeemed way of doing work. And, in fact, we think that work is actually a part of our call as human beings. In fact, it precedes the fall. It's not, we don't just work because we're fallen and there's scarcity and we need to eat. We work because we're created in the image of the creative God, and God wants us, in a sense, to participate in the creative activity of, he creates a world and then he leaves the world in a certain state. It's not, it hasn't done everything that it could do, and then he leaves it to us to be able to do things with the created order that that weren't there before. And so we think it's actually a part of our calling as human beings to work and to create value.
Sure. Well, and there was work even before the fall. I think that when you look at work as a curse mm-hmm. versus work as a blessing, as a part of our DNA, then you really need to go back to the pre-fall time in Scripture. So that is that's
you
all.
Do.
Yeah.
It's there. I mean, this is something that every Christian, you know, that's at all well catechized has read those first two chapters of Genesis. But it's easy to think that the fall itself is what caused work, because then Adam was cursed to work and toil. But work is toil in which your work, there's a kind of futility to it because the earth won't sort of do what you want it to do. That's one thing. But, you know, God created man and woman, created Adam and Eve, put them in the garden, and then commanded them to be fruitful and multiply and to till and to keep the garden. That happened before the fall. So, yes, God set up a garden at the beginning, but he told them, you need to till it and to keep it. That's work, and that was a part of the sort of creation mandate before the fall ever happened. And it's really important, I think, for Christians to always remember that.
Sure. It's essential. Well, in your book, The Human Advantage, The Future of American Work in the Age of Smart Machines, one of your key ideas is, you know, going back to farming, is how we have technologically improved how we do things. And in farming, we've made tools better from an early state. We invented fire. We had a printing press. And so technology has changed many, many times, and it's generally helped to create jobs. So how does this technological change and creation of jobs and adapting fit into your thinking?
Well, the book is in part written as a response to this kind of hysteria that we're about to have permanent so-called technological unemployment. In other words, artificial intelligence and robotics, they're not just going to enhance our labor, they're going to actually replace not only our labor, but replace us. So that, you know, I mean, there are lots of experts saying that humans are essentially going to be obsolete in the future because machines are going to do everything. And I think it's deeply misguided. I think it's a misinterpretation of technology. Of course, I can't prove what the future jobs are going to be because they don't exist yet. And so that's why I spend a lot of time in history saying, look, anybody, you could make this argument for permanent technological unemployment at any stage of technological development. The first time somebody figured out to hit two flint rocks together to start a controlled fire, they were, in a sense, you know, commandeering the forces of nature to do something they wouldn't do on their own for a purpose. The first time somebody used a shovel, they made an old way of digging obsolete. And so any time we develop a technology that enhances our labor, we're making an old type of work, an old way of working, You think of that as an old job, obsolete. But it doesn't mean that leaves us with nothing to do. It just, what it does is it changes the market. And so I think the strongest example of this would be the shift from the agrarian stage of the economy and actually of the American dream to the industrial stage. In the time of the American founding in 1776, 95% of the population was living and working on farms. Today, it's way less than 2%. In fact, it's almost 1% of the population. Now, if you were to be told that ahead of time, you might have thought, oh, my word, you know, 94% of the human or the American population is going to be unemployed in the future. Well, of course, that's not all what happened. Yes, there was disruption in which people's ways of life changed, but new and actually better jobs emerged as the price of food and the cost for producing food goes way down. Suddenly, people's labor is freed up for doing other things, and people's constant ingenuity, we find new things to do and new ways to create value. And so I just don't think that, yes, even though artificial intelligence and robotics are going to be hugely disruptive, there is no reason to believe that if we don't adapt ourselves, the future can't also be bright. And so that's really the challenge of the book, is to say, look, do not think that high technology, just because it's different from other types of technology, is going to make humans obsolete. It's just not true.
Good. Okay. Well, we'll get back more to what we're seeing and what's happening and some of the doomsday kind of predictions from people like Hawkins and Bill Gates and others. But one of the things you develop in the book is this connection of virtue and how we do business. And you're not dealing with the seven virtues, you know, prudence and faith and hope and charity and the things we usually think about, but you have some other virtues. So when you think about virtue in the world of exchange, where we have business and company formation and trade and jobs, what's the connection there? How does virtue work? How does virtue play itself out?
Yeah. Well, it's two things. One is that the ability to develop virtue. So virtue is essentially a positive thing you can develop about yourself based upon repeated, habitual, intentional action. So if you want to be a punctual person, get up on time and show up on time. You do that enough. At first it's hard. Then it becomes a habit. And then eventually, if you keep at it and have focused attention on it, it becomes a part of who you are. And since you kind of reprogram yourself to be more than you were at the beginning, that's virtue. And I argue that, in fact, the key thing that distinguishes man from machine is the fact that we exercise freedom. We're conscious agents that can act for purposes. We can develop virtue. Unless we're free and conscious and are intelligent agents, we can't do that. And so in many ways, virtue is one of the things that distinguishes us from machines. And so then the question I realized is, okay, so what's the information economy like? What are the key features of the new economy that's now emerging? And then what would be the virtues that would best help us to be able to adapt and to prosper and to flourish in that economy? And so in the book, I work out really what I call the five features of the information economy, one of which is that I've already mentioned, it's highly disruptive. Things change very quickly. Certain ways of doing things become obsolete very quickly. The corresponding virtue to that is courage. Courage is the virtue in which you're willing to act even in the context of possible failure. And that's absolutely, that's a crucial virtue because things change so quickly that you can't know the future directly. So you've got to be willing to try things even in the context of failure. And that's courage. That's the willingness to do that. Of course, that's not the only virtue, but that's the first one that I argue that you need. And I go on and build these sort of five virtues. Now, I should say that all the basic virtues, all the spiritual and moral virtues that are traditional are also hugely important. Prudence, for instance, you mentioned, which is seeing the world as it is and acting accordingly. In many ways, these are all a function of prudence. What we want to do is say, what's the world really like? What do I need to do? And how do I need to change myself in order to be able to flourish in it?
Sure. Well, C.S. Lewis just always seems to come to mind, and he said courage is where all the virtues come together, and it's that sense. And one of the things I really enjoyed in reading your book was how you used entrepreneurial examples, people who did something to illustrate that. And Dairy Do is a pretty descriptive term. I think people would kind of know. But tell us about Brad Morgan. How did he exhibit courage?
Oh, he's probably my favorite story. And as you mentioned, he started out a dairy farmer in sort of central Michigan, but was a small family dairy farm and really was not succeeding at it. and thought, well, you know, I'm spending a bunch of money getting rid of all this manure for my dairy cows. I wonder if I could figure out how to compost it. He knew there was a market for natural fertilizer and compost, and so he hired some consultants. He said, oh, yeah, you could do this, but, you know, their proposal actually, there's no way for him to make a profit. And he just, with his own mother wit and familiarity with composting and manure, figured out a new way to compost the manure. In other words, take plain old manure and turn it into compost, which you can use on fields, you can use in your gardens, and to do it so quickly that he could actually make a profit. So now he ships in manure every year onto his land and composts it and then sells it. I love this story for several reasons. One, because notice Morgan had to have courage. He started out a dairy farmer that wasn't working, and he ventured out in another place to try compost farming. He actually did things contrary to what some of the official experts said. That was hugely courageous and bold. Also creative. He exercised the virtue of creative freedom because he found a new way literally to turn waste into wealth. I mean, usually when we're talking that way, we're speaking metaphorically. But in this case, he literally takes cow manure and turns it into a really rich, powerful plant food. And so it started out as a low-tech operation, but now when I was, you know, I actually did a documentary in which I told this story about 12 years ago, and in writing this book, I checked in with him again, and, you know, I got a high-tech operation with a full-time agronomist on staff and sells everything, almost everything over the internet now and things like this. So it's a great story, a kind of rags-to-riches story. It's a story of entrepreneurial courage and creativity, and it illustrates what successful entrepreneurship is, which is really creating something of values.
Yeah, and another one of your values is altruism. And, you know, there's a sense of doing what you call doing unto others as you'd want them to do unto you. And it requires maybe a vision for how something could be. So how is seeing a need and filling it different from maybe the capitalism as greed myth?
Yeah, I mean, this is the most pervasive myth that, you know, capitalism, or that's not my favorite term, but the free enterprise or market economy is really just about greed. It's about people saying, okay, how can I make a buck off of other people? And that you can do that in almost any economy, but that's not actually, if you think about the normal way in which business people and entrepreneurs succeed. If you're a butcher, yeah, you could try to sell spoiled meat, but you'd end up with a bunch of one-star ratings on Yelp and go out of business quickly. The best way for a butcher to succeed as a butcher is to provide meat that people want, that they will freely buy at a price that they're willing to pay, and to do it better than his competitors. In other words, for a butcher to succeed, the best thing he can do is think, what do other people need, and what can I do to actually provide it for them at a price they're willing to pay? That's being other-directed. I mean, the word altruism, it doesn't just mean being self-sacrificial. That's a type of altruism, to do something for other people that is at your own expense. Of course, Christ is the prime example of that. He dies for us. That's a type of altruism. But there's also what you might think of as commercial altruism, and that's where you figure out a way to serve other people in a way that also benefits you. And so you interact in a so-called mutually beneficial exchange. So the butcher makes money off of this operation, but he only makes money if somebody's willing to pay him and wants to depart with their money more than and wants the meat more than they want the money, and he's going to need the money more than he needs or wants the meat. That's beneficial on both sides. And so I really want people to think about enterprise and business as one way in which we can serve our fellow human beings. But what makes it unique is we serve our fellow human beings while also benefiting ourselves.
Yeah, and there's kind of an awareness. I have a high view of creativity and I put the arts, but also entrepreneurism and software design. Mm-hmm. You know, all creativity is a huge topic. So an entrepreneur that can see something or perhaps experience something like one of your other examples, Miss to Mrs., it's a great story about a woman's difficulties leading her to form a business to help other people with the same difficulty.
That's right. And Danielle Tate, actually, she lives here in the Washington, D.C. area, and she she wanted to go to medical school. She was a biology major, didn't get into – she ended up applying to the very best medical schools and didn't get into them, and so didn't try any others. But that's a funny part of the story. But for her, it was an abject failure. That's how it felt. And so she did sales in the pharmaceutical industry for a couple of years. And then met a guy and wanted to get married and had to change her name, lived in Maryland, and realized it took her 3 days and three different trips to the DMV in different places just to get her last name changed. And then she thought, you know, there's got to be a better way to do this. And her husband said, well, you should find out how to do it. She started studying it, realized, you know, there's a way to do this. We can develop a website, charge a fee, and help other brides-to-be be able to change their names for $30 and in 30 minutes. And she did that. And so it's a perfect example of something that, in her case, once she experienced failure, so she ended up doing something she never would have thought of was as a way to make money and have a career. But then she also had to say, okay, I don't want other people have to have this problem I had. It's really time-consuming and frustrating. I want to help future brides-to-be to be able to make this to work. And so she's done it, found a price point in which they can actually succeed as a business, and that, you know, a bride, heck, if you can spend 30 minutes and $30 or nuke the next 3 days getting your name changed, what are you going to do? And so, again, it's mutually sure. beneficial. That's altruistic. It showed courage in the context of failure. That's a great entrepreneur. That's a great story of entrepreneurship. I just love it.
Well, it seems that an entrepreneur or someone in sales either has to save somebody money or solve a problem. And almost
That's
everything
right.
boils
yeah.
down to that. And she found a way
to do both. And that solves a problem. And what's funny about it is that I noticed entrepreneur stories often, you hear about the exciting stuff, you know, turning manure into compost or finding a way to help people change their names easily. But the truth of the matter is Daniel Tate had to spend a couple of years reading a lot of boring stuff. She had to find out what are name-changing laws in all 50 states. She had to study the sociology of name-changing. And in some ways, successful entrepreneurs need to be willing to sort of bear a lot of boring and tedious labor in order to, you know, that other people don't have to do it. And so in some ways, you know, very often it's sort of like detective work. We love watching these detective shows on TV. When they catch the bad guy, but, you know, a lot of it is looking through phone records and stuff like that. And so, you know, I just think it's clear that the story of entrepreneurship is a story of exercising particular virtues. And I just don't think that's not what people have in mind when they think about enterprise or when they think about business. They think of a tuxedo-clad guy on the Monopoly game or some bad caricature of a business person from literature or from a movie. But that's not the normal way in which enterprise works.
Sure. In a free market, if you have an idea, you may have to do a lot of just behind-the-scenes grunt work to bring it to fruition and make it succeed. I certainly don't envy her figuring out how to get your name changed in 50 states. My gosh.
Oh, it's awful. I know. I'm so glad somebody else did that.
Yeah. Well, Jay, we're getting close to the end of our first segment here, so we'll take a break, and we'll come back and continue our exploration of the virtues and then get into more detail about artificial intelligence, what it means to us, what we should be concerned about, and the opportunities it creates. Since it's time for a brief break, we want to invite you to visit our website, hillcountryinstitute.org, to listen to past programs, which are also available on podcast as Hill Country Institute Live. We also ask for your help in supporting this program financially, since the radio stations like to be paid for their time. It's a funny thing about that, isn't it? Please visit hillcountryinstitute.org to make donations and let us know if you would like to sponsor this program on your local radio station as well. You can reach us at 512-680-7993. That's 512-680-7993, or donate online at hillcountryinstitute.org. For donations over $100, we have copies of The Human Advantage, The Future of American Work in an Age of Smart Machines by Jay Richards, or other books on faith and culture issues. Please stay with us. We'll be right back with more of Hill Country Institute Live.